Quaker Show, where liberty is our mission. Today is Wednesday, March 13th, 2013. My name is Ben Stone, and this is podcast number 280. Now, looking at my notes and everything, I figured out that I have already done this podcast. So I cheated a little bit, and I took an old podcast from September 2012, and I took off some of the a time-sensitive bit in the very beginning of the podcast. And so that's what you're about to hear. You're about to hear the podcast titled The Radical Asks the Invisible Questions. And this is from September 2012, but it's very applicable today in what we're doing. So here you go, from 2012. Now, the last podcast that I did was with, it was an interview with Minno Troyer, and I had a lot of fun doing the interview. You might have, if you're especially if you're tend towards being a religious person or a theist or, you know, anything like that, you might have scratched your head and wondered, why in the world did Ben take Minno in that direction and discuss that? I knew well ahead of time that he was an atheist, and I knew his position on that, and I had even questioned him ahead of time to make sure he was comfortable in us taking the conversation there. And so you might say, well, you know, because I am a theist, I believe in God, and so why would I bring somebody on and have them give a contrary opinion to what I believe? And so I want to touch that in sort of an odd way today, not specifically to pick on Minno, but I want to explain how important it is that each of us be as radical as possible and as independent as possible in the way that we think, so that we don't have, and this was really the point of having Minno on, was that his article that he had written in the Dollar Vigilante, it was really focusing on individuality, individual freedom, individual independence, and moving away from this collective mentality that people tend to move towards. So that's kind of what I wanted to use him as an example for this, and I'll get into that a little bit more as I try to develop this thought. To start off, just think about the state itself. Now, the state, and I've gone through this over and over and over again, so I'm not going to put a lot of emphasis on it today, but the state has built-in flaws. Into the structure of the state, there are specific weaknesses that are eventually the state is doomed as a functional entity, as a way for society, as a way for certain members of society to dominate other members of society. Eventually, the state will collapse on a worldwide basis. There will be no state at some point in time. And the reason why is because these flaws are built into the state, it doesn't actually produce anything. It only consumes. And at some point, it's going to, the amount of tyranny and the amount of consumption by the state is going to increase to the point of where literally there will be a market demand for liberty. Now, two things drive any market, really, but two things will drive this market for liberty. One will be the tyranny and the failure of the state, because the state, part of the illusion of the state is that it promises all these different things. It promises security, it promises good roads, it promises commerce, it promises safe travel, it promises all these things in different forms, but it can't provide any of those things very well, and at some point it won't provide any of those things at all. And all the time, the tyranny of the state constantly increases. The state worldwide is far more tyrannical today if you could measure it out on a scale and you could say how many humans are being terrorized by the state in one form or another today, and measure that out with the state at any other point in time, and by far the state is more tyrannical today than it's ever been in the past, and it'll be worse tomorrow, and the day after that it'll be worse more. Because that's the tendency of the state, that's the direction that it's doomed to follow, that path. It's part of its nature. So as the state increases in tyranny, and as the state continues to fail more and more to provide the things that it lies about and says that it does provide, as that happens, there's going to be an increase in the demand for liberty. But that's only one thing. I said the market for liberty requires two things, and the tyranny and the failure of the state is only one thing. The other thing that is required for the market to demand liberty is you. You being yourself and seeking truth and demanding individual liberty. As you do that, and as I do that, and as your neighbor does that, as each of us independently seek individual freedom, then, it's kind of like this. I said a second ago that every market has two parts. It has a supply and a demand. You have to have both of these to have a complete market. There's one of these memes, posters floating around on the internet where two guys are stranded on a desert island. There's like two guys, you know, tiny little island, one palm tree, and they're both leaning against the palm tree. And one of them says something about stimulating demand, and the other one just kind of shakes his head and goes, stupid Keynesian. Well, yeah, you have to have two things for any market. You have to have a supply and you have to have a demand. A demand by itself won't necessarily guarantee the supply, and a supply without a demand is useless. So these two things work hand in hand. So for us to have a market for liberty, and keep in mind, I've said this many, many times, once there's a market demand for liberty, the state can do nothing to stop it. The state can interfere with markets, the state can distort markets, but the state can't stop a demand. Once a demand comes in, and once there's a supply for that demand, the state cannot stop it. It can only fight it, it can distort it, but it can't stop it. So we have to have this supply and this demand for liberty. And the state is going to partially supply the demand by its failures and by its tyranny. But we have to be there on the supply side. Imagine it this way. Let's say there's millions of people that are hungry and they're looking for a specific round red fruit. But they have no idea what an apple is. They know they want something. They know they're hungry. And they kind of have this desire for a red, round fruit. But they don't actually know what an apple is. They've never seen an apple. Now, those millions of people who desire that apple, they may end up settling for salted, dried fish heads because it's food. And what they really want is food. See, but they don't get their apple. They don't get their that fruit that they imagine. Because you don't have both a supply and a demand. You have a demand, but you don't have a supply. And let's say you approach this marketplace, millions of people hungry, wanting a red, round fruit, but having no idea what an apple is. And even if you're standing there selling apples, they're probably going to end up buying dead fish heads. They're going to want the salted fish heads, even if you're standing there with an apple. Unless you can break through and show them what you have and bring it to them in a way that they can grasp, then they'll want the apple, because that's what they're there for to begin with. Now, consider this. Consider a situation with tyranny and a failure of state. Let's say like they had in France around 1800. There was a horrible tyranny, the state was just massively oppressive, and the state was failing to provide. Specifically, the state had gotten to the point where it provided bread for all the peasants. And within the cities, the state was not able to fulfill that demand. It was not able to fulfill that promise, that is, to provide bread for the masses. And so they had the combination of starving and being terrorized by their own government. And so there was this demand for liberty, but they didn't actually know what liberty was. And you can tell that by reading the French writings of the day. They had no concept of what liberty was. So they ended up with salted fish heads, pretty much. They ended up turning on themselves and having massive revolution and butchery and just horrible, worse than what they had had under the king. The revolution itself in France produced more tyranny than if they had not had a revolution. Because, you know, they may have wanted the apples, but they didn't understand what the apples were, and so they chose the salted fish heads. Well, and then that same thing has happened over and over through history. That's what happened in Russia. The Russian people were seeing the failure of their government. They were seeing this vividly, and they were feeling the tyranny of their government. And because the Russian government was involved in food schemes, people were starving in the big cities. And yet, the answer, as simple as it was, liberty was the answer. But they were sold fish heads instead. And they got communism. They got Soviet Russia. That's what they got instead. And a similar thing was happening. I mean, you could just go throughout history with this and go over and over and over. Whenever people get to a certain point with their government and the government is failing them, and typically there's starvation because typically the government has figured out some way to get control of the food supply and is feeding the poorest people in the country. And typically when this is happening, when the government has taken over the food supply to the point of where all the poor totally depend on the government itself for their existence, and then the government is failing at doing that, because the government always fails at that kind of thing, because it's based on socialism, and that's a whole different topic. So as this is taking place now, we have a situation where the government is failing, and the tyranny is increasing, and the government can't produce the things that it's promised that it will produce, and people fall to revolution. But when the revolution's over with, the tyranny is worse than it was. They've just reset the button, and they're right back in the same cycle. So unless you can convince the market to abandon the salted fish heads and embrace the apple, then you don't have a market for the apple. You don't have a market for liberty unless there are people there demanding and seeking individual freedom and liberty, and then showing that this is what you want. This is the product that you need. Once there's a market in our apple situation, once there's a market created for the apples, once you let people know this is what you need, this is what we have, and this is what you need, then people begin not only buying the apples, but that demand for apples creates incentives, and it creates innovation. And innovation is driven in a market by individuals thinking in ways that nobody else is thinking, radical thoughts. That's how innovation takes place, through radical individuals thinking things that nobody else is thinking. That's how innovation enters into a marketplace, and it can only enter the market when the government is not messing with the market, because when the government is messing with the market, it drives everyone towards a conformity, and conformity is the opposite of innovation. So you have to have these radicals that are free thinking and that are just trying everything different that they can come up with. And when you have that with the apple situation, like I was talking about, then pretty soon you start developing different kinds of apples. You know, once you've got the market set for apples, then the apple producers start to breed and develop different types of apples and different that match different tastes and so forth. And then different apples get on the market. But when you work and you strive and you innovate and you produce your own apple and you bring it on the market, the one thing you have to do is insist that it's the best apple on the market. This is how progress is achieved. This is how innovation is rewarded, by the individual apple producer taking that apple to the market and saying, this is different from anybody else's market. It's better than their It's better than their apples. It's better than anybody else on the market. And you need to buy this because it's what you want. And as people respond to that, then this creates more incentive for innovation, more radical thinkers coming up with all kinds of other radical ideas that can't be produced in a collective. Markets need innovation, but collectivism kills that innovation. Innovation comes from independent individuals refusing to accept what's being served to them. Now, consider this. I'm not Adam Kokesh. I'm not Ian Freeman. I'm not Ron Paul. I'm not Michael Dean. I'm not Lou Rockwell. I'm not Stefan Molyneux. And neither are you. Each of us has to be radically independent. Liberty is a condition of the individual. It's not a condition of the collective. And remember, this is what Minow and I were talking about on the last show. Liberty is a condition of the individual. The collective can never bring you independence and liberty and freedom. The collective is always moving towards conforming and adapting to meet that collective image. Conforming and adapting to the collective always breeds more slavery. And even if you insist upon calling that slavery liberty, it doesn't matter. Conforming and adapting to the collective breeds slavery. So, and it doesn't matter, you know, if Ben Stone is taking you to that collective, or if Ron Paul is taking you to that collective, or Stefan Molyneux, or Lou Rockwell, or Adam Kokesh, it doesn't matter who your great leader is that you've built up. Unless you're thinking radically, unless you're independently analyzing everything that comes to you, then you end up with this conforming to the community, to what everybody else is thinking. And you begin, you know, next thing you know, you're chanting slogans, in the Fed, four legs good, two legs bad. You have to break your mind away from the collective and realize that the only way we can achieve independence is through independence, through individual achievement. Anyone who insists that we all need to get together and push in one direction to achieve liberty, they're selling you a dried fish head. You need to stop and really look at what they're saying. Liberty can only be achieved on an individual basis as we demand it in our own lives and as we strive to refine and produce independence and freedom for ourselves. That's how we achieve freedom and independence. It's not through any kind of voting and deciding that we're all going to do it together. Now, here's a different way of thinking of this. There was a person recently that asked this question. Why are some people upset about having to show their proper identifications to vote when we have to show identifications to buy beer and cigarettes? Now, keep in mind, I'm not supporting people, overconsumption of beer, and I don't smoke, so it's not... This is not my point here. The person's asking this question, why is it? Why is it that some people are upset that they should have to show proper identification to vote when everybody has to show identification for simple little things like buying beer and cigarettes? Well, in this situation, what you're talking about is using conformity to promote conformity. You've failed to ask the real question. If you're looking at the question, why do we need to show identification to vote? And you're thinking about identification for things like beer and cigarettes, you've failed to ask the real question. When I get back from this commercial, I'm going to talk about that a little bit more. Stay with me, I'll be right back.
Want caviar sound on a cat food budget? Creamy Radio Audio by the Freedom Fiends has great free tips so you can sound like a pro without spending like one. The most powerful form of human communication is one person speaking to another. But if people have to suffer through your sound, they'll change the channel and miss your message. With articles on microphones, preamps, recorders, mastering, recording remotely over the internet, doing a podcast, even getting a show on actual radio, the Freedom Fiends show you what they use and where to get it. Whether you're a talk show host, voiceover artist, podcaster, evangelist, or just want to record your loved ones for the ages, at Creamy Radio Audio, the Freedom Fiends will help you make the most of your sound. Creamy Radio Audio will help you speak to the world with sound that will make people want to keep listening. Check out CreamyRadioAudio.com. That's CreamyRadioAudio.com.
Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break. So this person asks, why are some people upset about having to show their proper identification to vote when we have to show identifications for things like beer and cigarettes? Isn't voting more important than, you know, something like buying beer or cigarettes? Why is it that a 30 or even older 30-year-old person in the U.S. has to show identification to buy something like cigarettes or beer, and then some other people are upset that something as important as voting requires your identification. Well, again, this is an example of how conformity is used to promote conformity. You failed to see the real question. You failed to ask the real question. Why do you have to have government papers to identify yourself? That's the real question. Why do we allow government to tell us what we can and can't buy and sell? Why do we want to participate in the democratic process when the democratic process itself is based on aggression? When people vote, what is it that they're really doing? When you vote, you're attempting to use the government to accomplish the things you want to accomplish. You're willing to use the aggression of government to force your will upon other people. And that's the essence of democracy. That's the essence of a democratic system. And we can play word games and talk about a democratic republic, or it's a pure democracy, but all those are word games. All that is just paint on the surface of the monster. It's nothing really that matters. It's just all different words. When it boils down to it, when you vote, what you're really trying to do is have an influence in the government to get the government to do the things you think are important. And the government can only do something at the cost of somebody else, because the government is entirely parasitical. The government produces nothing on its own. The government can only consume what it steals. So when you involve yourself in the democratic process, and voting is the ultimate involvement in the democratic process, when you're doing that, you're using the force of government to accomplish what you want by your desires. You're putting your desires onto other people using the force of government. So the radical has to step away and not ask, you know, why are some people upset about showing their identification of vote? The real radical has to say, why do I need an identification? Only the radical independent individual can step out of the collective and dig down to the truth and really find the question that matters. Why do I have to carry government papers? And the answer is because if I don't, they'll beat me. They'll maybe even kill me. I can't, they'll starve me. I can't just go anywhere I want to go, do whatever I want to do, even if I'm not harming anybody else. I can't freely travel from one place to another without having government identification. Try it. Just try it. Now, sure, you can get out and you can start walking, and for a while you can walk. But at some point in time, some government agent on some level is going to stop you, and he's going to want to see your identification. And if you don't have it, there's a good likelihood they're going to incarcerate you. They require us to register ourselves with the government. And if you resist this process, your ability to move around will be stifled. Your ability to buy and sell and trade, your ability to work. How difficult is it in the U.S. today to actually work a job without government identification? It's pretty much impossible. It's not impossible. Some people can do it. But it's very difficult, and you will have a very hard time. So without it, without the government papers, they want to starve you, they'll beat you, they'll even kill you. You can't work, you can't travel, not in freedom. So I'm forced by the government to have a government ID so I can form. Not by my will, but in order to get by, I have a government ID. But I'm not forced to vote. Not yet, anyway. But tyrants tend to get around to that eventually. They usually always do. They usually always get to the point of where voting is required. Here's some things you may not know about. Did you know that elections are held in North Korea every 5 years? North Korea has elections every 5 years. And they elect their legislator, and they elect representatives to city councils, to county councils, to provincial assemblies. They have elections on all these different levels. And North Korea, has a multi-party system. They have the Workers' Party that carries about 85% of the seats generally. They have the Korean Social Democratic Party that usually gets about 7% of the seats. And they have a party, I'm going to mess up the name, but it's something like Chondoisk. I don't know. I can't figure it out. My pronunciation of North Korean words is not so great. But this party gets about 3% of the seats in government every election. And they have about another 2% of election winners that are independents, that are not a part of those three major parties. This is in North Korea, folks. And they generally have a 100% or near 100% voter turnout. You have to. You're required. But most people don't know that about North Korea, that's how their system works. Keep in mind, in 2002, Iraq held national elections, and Saddam Hussein won with 100% of the vote and almost a 100% voter turnout. And you say, well, yeah, but these elections are fake. Well, I don't know. Are they? I mean, really, are they? The people actually turn out in North Korea, and they actually vote. And those are the actual numbers. And with Saddam Hussein, the people actually came out. They came out and voted. They were there. There was observers. It was clear that they actually came out and voted, and they voted for Saddam Hussein. So when you say that the Iraq elections or North Korean elections are fake, are you talking about maybe like the 2012 Republican primary that was fake? Because it was. Think about it. If you don't believe me, you know, just Google 2012 Republican primary fake. And state after state after state after state, the Republicans blatantly cheated. And nothing's going to be done about that. The American elections are fake, folks. In 2008, there were Black Panthers standing, holding baseball bats in front of the election, polling places in cities. And nothing was ever done about that. The elections in the U.S. are fake. If you believe the elections in North Korea are fake, just take a look at the actual evidence of the 2012 Republican primaries. The elections are fake. So then why are they important? The radical has to ask the question, why do tyrants have to have elections? They're in power by aggression. They're more than willing to use force to crack down on anybody who opposes them. So why do tyrants have elections? Why is there an election? Why did Saddam Hussein have an election? Did he think it would prove to the U.S. anything? Of course not. He wasn't that stupid. Did he think it would prove something to the U.N.? Well, clearly it didn't work. Why does North Korea continue to have elections? You see, the radical has to burn down through all the nonsense and ask the harder, deeper questions. What about America? Will voting become mandatory in America? This is a logical progression. Of course, voting at some point will become mandatory. Now, so the radical asks, how? How will Americans be forced to vote? It's a funny thing. Why does the state need to control our food supply? Why does the state insist upon having its grips on things like butter and cheese and milk and wheat and corn and oats and sugar? Why is the government so involved in the food production, controlling the distribution of food, controlling the prices of food? Well, I always like to go back to something I learned from James C. Scott in The Art of Not Being Governed. You see, the state needs slaves. The state, at every point in history, has existed on the backs of slaves. Today, the slavery is a little different than it was, say, in the mid-1800s. But today, the state exists on the backs of slaves. Slaves like you and slaves like me. Slaves that know that we have to have our card, we have to show our identification, we have to in order to work, in order to trade, in order to travel. We have to have our permission slips. In that sense, we're no different than the slaves in the mid-1800s, except there's just a lot more of the population that's enslaved today than there was in the mid-1800s. You see, the state has to have slaves to exist, and the state always uses food to control those slaves. It always has. Since the very early points of the state's existence, the overproduction of grains and the control of the food by the state was absolutely necessary. If you're a biblical, if you're familiar with the Bible and you like to refer to the Bible, go back and read how the Pharaoh controlled the people by the use of food, by the use of grains. That's the whole story of Joseph is about that, about how Joseph goes in and literally shows the Pharaoh how to control the population during emergency times by taxation and by control of the food supply. That's what the story of Joseph is all about. So why does the state require that? Why does the state have to control the food? And here's the other thing. The state has found out over the years, over the centuries, over the thousands of years, that certain foods are make it easier to control the slaves. So, for instance, James C. Scott goes into this pretty well in detail in The Art of Not Being Governed. Things like, if you're going to be radicals living out there outside of the state, you tend to grow things that are not grain-based. You tend to grow things like, you know, sweet potatoes are really, really important in non-state societies. If you get into Africa, in ancient days in Africa, yams, which is different from sweet potatoes actually, yams were important non-state food. But it's through the introduction of grains and the overproduction of grains and the state control of grains that the traditional food supplies are crushed and the people are forced to accept the state. Now, eventually, food in the United States is going to be tied to voting. Maybe that's an obvious statement to you. Maybe it's not an obvious statement. But right now, more and more, the government wants more and more people to depend on food, what we call food stamps generally, but now there's no stamps, it's a card. It's like a government-issued debit card that that millions of Americans depend on their food for that government-issued card. And now we have an ID card, which is also a food card. At what point will the food card, the ID card, and the voting card all be the same card? At what point will you be required to show your proof of voting in order to get your issuing of food, your ration of food? Now, this is not immediate. This is not happening in the next 6 months or even maybe not this next 6 years. Maybe not even in the next 50 years. But there's a logical progression here of where these things have to be connected together at some point in time. And at some point in time, in order for you to get your government allotment of cheese and butter and grain, you're going to have to show that you voted. It's all going to be on the same recording device. And we think of cards, you know. Today we think of cards, but cards can be faked. Eventually it's going to be some system that's going to be harder to crack and harder to fake. There's going to be some other system, and I'm not going to venture guesses on that. All I'm saying is that eventually voting will be mandatory. It will be absolutely demanded of everybody. And it's my sincere belief that food will be used as the method of forcing the vote upon people, whether they want to or not. Now, think about, let's shift directions and go a little bit slightly different direction. The radical has to ask the invisible question. The radical has to go beyond what's obvious and what's laid out for everybody to see. And in order to get the radical answer, in order to get the truth behind all the smoke and mirrors, the radical has to go for the invisible question that nobody wants to talk about. Leaders and movements can't teach you how to question leaders and movements. Do you get that? You have to be the radical. You have to look beyond what you're being fed. Remember the radicals of the 60s? Do you remember the Haight-Ashbury hippie love fest flower child anti-war give peace a chance crowd? They constantly chanted the mantra of unity. Think back about the songs that were popular in the late 60s and early 70s. All you need is love, come together, let's get together, why can't we be friends? It was all about unity. It was all about let's set aside the little things that are different about us and let's all get together on these major issues of peace and love and all that. Well, where did that all lead to? What happened with all that? They begged for us to set aside our differences and embrace unity. That's what it was all about. But you know what? Unity sucks. Unity can only be achieved by setting aside your convictions, by taking that which makes you, you, and flushing it down the memory hole. That's where unity comes from. Unity is Ayn Rand dismissing her followers from her presence simply because they had some point of disagreement with her, or they failed to conform to her wishes. That's what unity is about, and that's not what independence is, and that's not what freedom is. Now, there's nothing wrong with getting together, friends getting together, people of like-mindedness getting together and enjoying each other's company and having fun. You know, I think of Porkfest. I talk about that quite often because I was there this year, and it was fantastic. It was quite an event. In all the things of my lifetime, it's one of the things that are going to stand out. So there's nothing wrong with getting together. There's nothing wrong with having a certain like-mindedness among people. But you can't abandon your independence and your radicalness in order to conform to what your leaders and what your movement and what your group is saying. And that was, in one way, that was one of the really wonderful things about Porkfest, because there were radical, there were radicals there from every shape and every color and every bend. They were all there, and they were all, you know, to a certain extent, there was civil argument and civil discussion, but there was also independence, and there was this radical tone that stayed through the whole thing. And that's absolutely necessary. But unity is asking someone else to tell you how to think, rather than seeking core principles and demanding that truth at any cost. When you demand truth at any cost, and that's even the cost of your own ego or the cost of what you already believe, demanding the truth no matter what. See, that's the thoughts of the radical, and that's what Menno and I were talking about in that last in the last podcast. When I come back from this break, I'm going to see if I can wrap this up for you and bring this together, and maybe you can see a little bit more of where I'm going with this. Stick with me. I'll be right back. From June 17th through June 23rd of this year, the Free State Project will celebrate its 10th annual Porcupine Freedom Festival, Porkfest. My wife Cindy and I plan on attending, and Bad Quaker staff members Hannah and Matt are trying to raise enough money to attend, as they did last year. Considering fuel, campground fees, and Porkfest tickets, we estimate it will cost BadQuaker.com a little over $2,000 for Cindy and I to attend. For Matt and Hannah to attend, it should cost an additional $700. If you'd like to take part in sending the Bad Quaker crew to Porkfest 10, here's how you can do it. Go to badquaker.com. You can click on the donate button on the right-hand side of the page. You can give us bitcoins with our bitcoin number located right below the donate button. Or you can use our Amazon button to shop at Amazon. If you'd like to support badquaker.com on a regular basis, you can use the link to our forum and become a supporting member for only $4 a month or just $25 a year. Thanks, folks. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break. So, unity. Unity is repeating the slogans of your master without considering the meanings of the words or the consequences of the phrase. That's what unity is all about. Unity is chanting in the Fed, without realizing what will happen when government acts to end the Fed. What will happen when the demand for the government to change, for the demand for the government to fix the government. What will happen when the government obeys that command and the government acts to change the government? Do you think things will get better? Have they ever? Has the government ever taken solid, radical steps to improve government and actually produce more freedom and more liberty? Has the government ever done that? What will happen when the government hears your chants of end the Fed, and it responds to those chants, and it ends the Fed? What will it do then? What will take the place of the Fed? And the obvious answer is, the government will take the place of the Fed. But before we get into that, you know, Menno and I were discussing the existence or the non-existence of God. And I invited Menno. And we talked about it before the interview even began, so I knew where he was going with this. And so I let Menno completely explain himself. Now, why would I do that? Well, let's think about this for a second. Well, before I do, here's a different thought. This has nothing to do with Menno. This is just a thought that popped into my head. What if humans asking about the existence of God or discussing the existence of God, what if it's kind of like an ant? If there was an ant talking to another ant, and they're under a table at Buckingham Palace, and one ant says to the other ant, have you ever seen the Queen? And the other ant says, what are you talking about? And the first ant says, well, we do all this work every day. We go out, we risk our lives, we gather food, we bring it back to the hole, we go down in the hole, we give the food to other ants. But I've never seen the Queen. Have you ever seen the Queen? And the second ant says, you know, come to think of it, I've never seen the Queen, but I believe there is a Queen. Now, is it possible that humans talking about the existence or non-existence of God is kind of like two ants under a table at Buckingham Palace discussing whether or not the Queen is real? And the whole time, they can't even conceive in their mind who's eating at the table above their heads. Is that possible? Is it possible that humans discussing God is really that silly? Maybe not. I don't know. Back to Menno. You know, neither of us, neither Menno nor I, requires the other to conform. And yet, at least one of us in this discussion is wrong. If Menno is right, and there is no God, then I'm wrong, because I believe there is a God. And if I'm right, and there is a God, then Menno is wrong. So at least one of the two of us is wrong. And yet I invited him on the show, I knew his position ahead of time, and I still asked him to explain it. And then I didn't interrupt him, I didn't contradict him, I didn't attack him. I let him speak his piece. Now why would I do that? The reason is because if you have confidence in your own position, confidence in your own position means not being offended or afraid when someone else disagrees with you. Ultimately, the market drives out bad ideas and rewards good ideas. So if I'm right in this discussion between Menno and I, if I'm right, eventually my position will win out in the market of ideas. But if I'm wrong, then eventually my position will fail in the market of ideas. I think about apples. I was talking about apples earlier. How many crab apples do you see for sale at the grocery store? Do you see that very often? Well, actually, crab apples used to be a sellable product. But in the marketplace, better apples have won out. And now there's a variety of wonderful apples you can choose, but you don't see any crab apples at the market. And there's a reason for that. It's because that's what the market does. The market pushes out the failures, and it rewards the winners. And that's what the market does. Now, I want to take this in a slightly different direction. I was talking about the Federal Reserve earlier. But before I jump into that, I found out something else. You know, there's been a lot of fuss about Stefan Molyneux talking about making somewhat silly statements about martial arts. And there's a lot of confusion, and there's a lot of anger about that. There's a lot of people chanting mantras right now. And I got to looking around a little bit, and I found out that actually Stefan Molyneux was repeating almost word for word what was said in a Penn and Teller video. Penn and Teller did a video on martial arts. It was part of their series. I can't remember which television network does their series, but... And I can't say the name of their series right here at this time, right now, and maintain my G rating with iTunes. But Penn and Teller, in their series, it's a wonderful series, I really like it, did a debunking of martial arts. Except, what they really did was they pigeonholed all martial arts into three types. The silly kung fu movie type martial arts, pop trends, And one particular example of a guy that was a pretty rough individual teaching a type of martial arts that's basically true self-defense. And they beat that guy up pretty bad, and they used a lot of straw man arguments, and they really failed to address the real topic. And of course, they didn't go into any of the things that are true martial arts, that are Western martial arts or African martial arts or South American martial arts. They didn't go into any of those. There are Native American martial arts. They didn't go into any of those that focus on mental discipline, on physical fitness, on flexibility. They didn't go into any of that stuff. They only did the pop trends. And so, to a certain extent, I can't blame Stefan, because Penn and Teller made that blunder first. And the Liberty community didn't call out Penn and Teller on it like they have Stefan Molyneux. I think maybe what we're seeing here is people following leaders rather than being radical thinkers on their own. Now, when we start talking about ending the Fed, which is what I was talking about a second ago, and you start to chant that mantra because you heard Ron Paul say it, and you got real excited, maybe you read a book about the Federal Reserve, and you realize how evil it is, and so you want to end the Fed, end the Fed, end the Fed, and you start chanting and chanting, but you don't think about how that will take place. You don't think about the fact that you're playing into the hands of your owners, that you're playing the fool, that you're being used. When you chant that slogan and you follow the collective, you're not thinking about the consequences of the government ending the Fed, the government taking action to change government. You're not thinking about that. You're not thinking about the fact that you're asking government to fix government. So what should be done about the Fed? It's like everything else that the government touches. What should be done about the highways? The government is consuming massive amounts of your money, stealing your money for perpetual construction on the highways in order to keep fat cat politicians with lots of funding coming in for their reelection while having mobster union bosses and their cousin's construction company perpetually employed on construction that never ends, on bridges that are replaced over and over and over, on projects that have been going on for years and money flowing into them. It's just like the Fed. Do you expect the government to suddenly fix that? But when you demand the government fix the government, are you thinking about this? When the government ends the Fed, and it will, when the government ends the Fed, what will it replace it with? It will replace it with a true fiat, government-issued greenbackers. You see, when the Fed was created back in 1910, when the Fed was first created as a private banking company, when it was created as a private entity back in 1910, the reason why the Fed was able to be pushed onto the American people, and the reason why the trick had to happen, is because the American people had already seen what the greenbacker plan had done. The greenbacker plan had already destroyed the value of the dollar during Lincoln's war. So it was fresh in the memory of Americans what greenbacker policies would do. It'll destroy the value of the dollar. That's exactly what they'll do. That's what the Confederacy in the South used, the same greenbacker policy. So did Lincoln's administration. And they destroyed the value of the money. So people saw firsthand, this is what greenbackers will do. And so they rejected, they were in the process of rejecting the concept of the greenbacker. But the government needed fiat money because they needed to get into the bigger wars. They couldn't afford, if you think about the wars that the U.S. government involved itself in from Lincoln's war until 1910, they were all basically minor skirmishes compared to, say, Lincoln's war or World War I. And what's the big difference? Lincoln's war and World War I were both financed by fiat money. Lincoln's war was financed by greenbackers. World War I was financed by the Federal Reserve. You see, the government needs fiat money in order to have its perpetual wars. And we already know that war is the health of the state. So the only way the government can perpetuate its wars is with fiat money. And it doesn't care if it's greenbacker money. Socialist, I should just call it socialist, because that's what the greenbacker policy is. It's socialism. It's the government controlling the means of production. That's socialism. That's what the greenbacker policy is. When you want Congress to control the money supply, you're asking the government to give you socialism. That's what you're doing. So the American people wouldn't buy socialism in 1910. So they were offered the Federal Reserve, and they were conned into accepting it. And with that, we see that for 100 years, the American government could afford perpetual massive wars. And now the scheme is falling apart. And the generation that remembered what greenbacker money does is all gone. So what's the government going to do? The government allows its scheme to be seen. It allows its plan to be exposed. And then the government says, oh, I have the answer. Here's the answer. The government's going to provide you the answer. The same government that provided you 100 years of nonstop war is now going to fix the Federal Reserve by getting rid of it and putting that power into the hands of Congress. The con that wouldn't work 100 years ago will work now, because all who remember it are dead. And so you ask the government, you beg the government, you beg your master, end the Fed. And the master says, okay, I'll do that for you. I'll end the Fed. And then he hands you something worse. And we start the con all over again. And what happens when that greenbacker scheme dies? Well, the IMF is going to have to step in, isn't it? The IMF is going to have some kind of a commodity-backed dollar of some kind. But in the long run, it'll still be fiat. It won't have a solid backing. It won't have a solid... Remember, Bob Murphy and I talked about that on the interview with Bob Murphy on this show. At some point in time, the IMF is going to offer a fake commodity-based money. But it won't really be commodity-based, because in a sense, the U.S. dollar was commodity-based partially throughout the 20th century for most of it. But it was all a scam, and we saw that starting in the 70s, and the inflation that's happened ever since then. We see that it's a scam, and the IMF will do the same trick. And how is it that the IMF will be able to pull that trick off? Well, because... it's happening. We're talking about something that's going to happen years down the road, when no one remembers the last time the scam was pulled, and the same scam gets pulled again and again. The greenbacker scam gets replaced by the Federal Reserve scam. One just replaces the other. And how is it that we can break this cycle? We have to stop relying on the collective for the answers to our problems. Stop expecting government to fix government. Stop trying to get involved in government and putting your own money and your energy and your time and your effort into fixing that which is the problem. You need to live your life independently. Make everything in your life for the purpose of making your life better, not for the purpose of improving the collective, not for the purpose of fixing government, not for the purpose of influencing government to do the things you want it to do. All the energy you put into doing that is wasted energy. What I want to do, what I demand that I will do, is take back every moment that's given to me in my life and move everything I can, everything that's in my way, move it out of my way. If I can move it out of my way, and find out what I can do to live my life as free, as independent, and as happy as possible. Not harming others. Seeking every way possible to not harm anyone else, but to only make sure that my life is as good as it can be. And when I'm doing that, when I'm securing for my own future, preparing for anything that might be coming at me, and in the process, this influences those around us. As others around us begin to see that we're moving these obstacles out of our way, and we're preparing for a better life, no matter what the government does, we're preparing to enjoy however much of life is left in front of us. And we're not preparing to depend upon other people, or depend on the collective, or depend on the government to fix the government, depend on any of these collective means to make our lives better, but instead demand that we make our life better. Here's a real brief example before I end today's show. My grandfather... he died before I was born, but my family called him Poppy. Poppy was a businessman. He ran a small store and a small farm, and out in Appalachia, out in the country. And he worked and worked and worked his whole life. And he had a nail keg that he kept, and he saved money. And he would put, every time that he would get a chance, he would put a gold coin into that nail keg. Now, the average gold coin in the U.S., this is like in the 1920s, the average gold coin was the $20 gold piece, and it was roughly an ounce. So whenever he got a chance, he would put a $20 gold piece in this nail keg. Now, by the early 30s, the nail keg was almost full. And in 1933, April 5th, 1933, Franklin Roosevelt outlawed the private ownership of gold coins. They set up a $10,000 fine and 10 years in jail if you were caught with gold coins. Now, that's considering the change in the economy, that's about a $200,000 fine today for possessing gold coins. The government was paying, through the banks, the government was paying $20 an ounce for those gold coins. But the actual value on the market was about $35 an ounce. But you were required by law to give up your coins to the government. Now, Poppy had this nail keg full of gold coins, and he kept it hidden behind his bed. And his wife found it one day, my grandmother. And they were very upset. The whole family was very upset that Poppy had kept this whole nail keg full of $20 gold pieces. When you had that kind of a fine facing you, those days, $10,000 fine and 10 years in jail, that's pretty rough. And so they forced Poppy to take his gold coins into the big city and deposit them in the bank and get money back out instead. So Poppy took his nail keg and he went into town. And he didn't want to. He didn't trust the banks and he didn't want to do it. But it's what the government required. And so he took his nail keg into town and he went into the bank and he tried to cash them out. But there was a limit, you see. You could only get, because there was also bank runs that were going on. So the government had put limits. You could only get something like $600 out from the bank at any one time. But they wouldn't let Poppy leave with his gold coins. They literally had an armed guard in the bank, making sure federal officers were in banks, making sure that people did not walk out with gold coins. So Poppy had to leave his whole nail keg full of gold coins. He had to leave it at the bank, and all he could draw out was $600. And a few weeks later, before he could get back and draw the rest of his money, of course he could only draw out $600 at a time, before he could get back and draw out his money, the bank closed. There were a lot of bank closings in the 30s, and the bank closed, and all his money was gone, just like that. Because Poppy conformed. Poppy did what he was told. Think about what it would be like if the family had that nail keg full of gold coins. Think about what his grandchildren could have faced if Poppy had only said, you know what, I don't care what the government's doing or saying. I'm not going to do this. I'm going to live my life for me, and I'm going to do what's best for me. And in doing that, he would have done the best for his whole family. His act of what might be called selfishness would have actually been an act of mercy for his whole family, had he only acted in his own benefit rather than allowing the collective to push him where they wanted him. In the Fed? Are you sure? Have you thought it through? Can government fix government? Where's your faith lie? Folks, for more on liberty, property rights, and the Zero Aggression Principle, go to badquaker.com. And thank you very much for listening today.